It's Wednesday here on Prairie Public, time for another edition of Main Street. We are pleased that you are with us. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Coming up in just a bit on today's show, we'll visit with artist Guy Nelson, and he'll take us into the layered world of Tales from the Understory, his new exhibition exploring nature, resilience, and human connection that can now be seen at the North Dakota State Art Museum on the campus of the University of North Dakota. We'll also visit with writer Tamara Dean. She joins us to reflect on her deeply personal journey of sustainable living in the driftless area of Wisconsin in her new book, Shelter and Storm. But we begin Main Street today with another edition of Prairie Plates, and we'll introduce a new restaurant that's just opened in downtown Fargo.
I like bagels.
Have some salad.
All right, eat pizza.
Eat some barbecue.
Applesauce and some nice red beets.
There's the music we look forward to each and every Wednesday here on Prairie Public. It's time again for Prairie Plates. Rick, you and I took maybe a week or so vacation from having our weekly segment here, but glad to have you back. How's it going?
It's going well, Craig. How are you?
Doing just fine. But we have a special guest. We're thrilled to welcome Nikki Ness-Berglund to the studio. Nikki's the creative force behind Nova Eatery and Supper Club and a proud part of the Luna Network of Restaurants. Nikki, welcome to Prairie Plates and Main Street.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Rick has sampled some of the cool new Nova dinner menus at the old Birnbaum's. How are things going and how was it to walk through the process really of starting kind of a Nova Eatery and Supper Club almost from scratch? How did you approach it?
It felt a little bit serendipitous. I mean, we did have Nova Eatery inside the old Fargo Brewing, and unfortunately, we closed that at the end of last year. I think November is when Fargo Brewing officially shut it down. I mean, it was no fault of anybody, but we were only a two-year-old restaurant at that time, so we needed to figure out really quickly what to do next. And then at the same time, sadly, Birnbaum's was closing, and we were huge supporters and lovers of Birnbaum's. First, I should say that. And we talked with Andrea and Brett and ultimately ended up deciding that we would take over that space. And the process went very quickly because we really needed it to. We were, you know, coming off a, I don't want to say failed restaurant, but a restaurant that was forced to close early. So we weren't exactly in a financial place to do that. So we did ask for some community help, which we were, oh my gosh, so happy to receive. Did some crowdfunding. And then, you know, it was a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, quick turnaround time. Somebody asked me at our soft opening if we had a designer, and that designer was named Nikki and Ryan, who is my business partner. My son helped one day. He's 11. He did some painting. Ryan's awesome. Wife. My chef, Andrew, came from Nova, and he is still our head chef of Nova Eatery and Supper Club.
This restaurant is on Broadway. Nikki, if I walk into it, which I haven't done yet, but I will very soon. What do you want me to feel?
I think we want to feel a comfort, first of all. We just want that really good feeling of being able to come in, whether you want a casual burger or you want a nice dinner out with your family. It is family friendly. Kind of just like a welcoming hug of a downtown space. We're going for a nostalgic feel. I personally have a lot of experience going to supper clubs in kind of that like lakes area. I lived in Minneapolis and they had some really cool like Polonaise room back in the day. I had a lot of Wisconsin friends in my college years. And then Ryan, also we want it to be comfortable, but also we do really quality ingredients and source everything still from scratch. And so,
Rick, give us a spoiler here. You've sampled some of the menu. How awesome is it?
Oh, it's really good. I had prime rib, hash browns, the grilled mushrooms. Those were really good. Grilled maitake mushrooms. Oh, boy, what else did I have? French onion soup. Cheese buttons on Saturday, I tried those. That's a Germans from Russia cuisine. And the chef is Germans from Russia, so if Michael Miller's listening, our friend Michael Miller. But yeah, I've had quite a few things and some desserts. And we've had Chef Mandy Dolny on previously to talk about some of her sweet treats, and she's making the sweet treats over there. So yeah, I've spent two sessions at Nova, and I give it two thumbs up. And I'm really excited that they're in downtown. Losing Birnbaum's was tough. It's in the former Birnbaum's location for all of you folks out there. But at the same time, these Nikki and Ryan are two times James Beard semifinalist nominee for Best Restaurateur. And if anyone is going to make this work, they will. They've done just a fantastic job, and the menu is great. So, and they open for breakfast today. So go try breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You won't be disappointed.
Awesome. Nikki, you have a background with wine. Tell me more about that.
Well, I'm from Fargo, but I actually moved away when I was when I graduated high school, and I did not move back until 2008. I was in my mid-30s, and during that time, my big girl job that when I didn't live here was I was in wine sales for quite a few years. So that was my, and then I guess also my family business is Bernie's Wines and Liquors. I'm third generation there, so.
When I come to the restaurant, A, can I make reservations, or do you just want me to just come in and then I'll be seated?
You know, until we've been in the restaurant business for 10 years, and until last year, we really hadn't dabbled in the reservation systems. And then we tried it over at Luna, our original restaurant, and it really went well, and I think people really liked it. So we do have a reservation system, and it's built. You can see it when you Google and also when you go to our website.
Nikki, what other restaurants do you own and manage in Fargo-Moorhead?
So Luna Fargo was our original, our first restaurant. It's on University, and that's where I met my chef, now business partner, Ryan. And then in 2019, we opened Soul Avenue Kitchen in Moorhead next to Junkyard. That was right before, unfortunately, before COVID. So that's been a rough ride, but we are still kicking. And then right after COVID, I mean, after, you know, everybody started getting back into business, we were asked by both Drecker and Fargo Brewing if we wanted to open restaurants. And we each liked one of the ideas. And that I don't even know what we were thinking. It was crazy times. So we opened. Technically, we now have four inside Brujala and then Nova Eatery. So
that would be Moongata, Luna Market, House of Nudes and Buns, and Unicorn Park Fine Foodery.
Correct.
And all of those kind of have different themes. Unicorn Park has like cheese curds and pub food, smash burgers, that sort of thing. Moongata is a wine raw bar. Luna Market has soup and sandwich for lunch. And House of Nudes and Buns is a little more on the Asian side. I almost forgot about that one. There's so many. But also over in Moorhead, talk about Soul Avenue a little bit.
I mean, Soul Avenue, I don't know. It's just such a special place to us. I mean, I love all of our places, but it's, I don't remember how we exactly came up, but it's meant to be kind of like street food idea. We do a lot of tacos. We do a lot of sort of Asian-inspired dishes, and it's just really become its own personality over the years. It's a kind of a whimsical, colorful place. And we had Guy Fieri there one time.
I was just going to ask about that. How was that? That was probably about 5 years ago now.
It was a little right bit after. I mean, he still, I think we were his first, Fargo was his first stop when he came back from COVID. So he would have, you know, everybody wore the mask still. And I think we were his first, or Fargo-Moorhead, I should say.
Nikki, I've got to tell you something.
Yeah.
I wondered what talk was, and so I Googled talk, T-A-L-K.
Oh, T-O-C-K.
I learned that, and I just made a reservation.
Oh
so
my gosh, that's
I can't
so exciting.
Wait. One thing I've wondered about, Nikki, with with folks like you are in your position, you're trying to plan ahead. And here we go. We have tariffs and other things that kind of impact the food industry. Are you able to locally source enough where it really hasn't been a problem for you yet?
I know for food, we have not seen it yet. We do, I mean, for all of our restaurants, we locally source as much as possible, and at least regionally when possible. You know, we try to keep it as close as we can. I do feel like there will be some things, but I'm trying to remember. My chef told me a few days ago there will be some things. I guess I don't think we've anticipated yet. I don't know what they're going to be exactly. We're a little nervous about the wine side. I do have a sommelier who does all our wine. I think he's been on, hasn't he, Alex? He's a little nervous. We don't do a whole lot from, we find the way we do our wine list, which is as clean and low intervention and just small little vineyards as we possibly can. That's might get a little tricky because there isn't as much of that in the United States. So we do source a lot of our products from other countries, but we don't know yet. Let's hope not.
Hey, Nikki, I'm going to trust you. When I walk in, I get to order one thing, of course.
Okay.
What should I order? if I have to limit it down
what
you like the best.
This feels very unfair. I don't know if I should do that.
I want to hear your recommendation.
Can I do one thing from each part of the menu?
Sure.
Okay. I mean, there are so many good things, first of all, but I feel like I got to say one or two. But appetizer-wise, I think the dark horse has been these ham and cheese buttons. We have a marketing friend who actually said, I think you should rename those. And we may, but they really are called cheese buttons. That is the – there's a German word that I don't know. What do you know the
That sounded
word?
Good when Rick talked about them. Sounds case, good to me now.
It's Case.
Yes, Case Nefla. That's the word. So we may rename them, but ham and cheese buttons, I've had a lot of people say that's the dark horse. The roasted bone marrow was a huge crowd pleaser there. As far as, I mean, I've been doing a lot that we do a Zabuton steak, which if you're not familiar, it's other people call it a Denver style steak. It's incredibly tender. It's more tender to me than like a petite filet.
And goodness.
It's really delicious, but it's not, you know, as fatty as, say, a ribeye. So the Zabuton is really delicious.
That sounds great.
And also on the not steak side, we have this fireman chicken that Chef Andrew, who is our head chef, we should talk a lot about him, Chef Andrew Doan, he came up with this fireman chicken, and it is absolutely, it's one of the first things I tried when we were starting to sample things, and it was just really good. We do a lot of great, we have a really good French onion soup that people have been raving about, and then on the sides, all our sides are huge, so, you know, you can share a few things and you get to kind of the run of the menu.
Let's spill into the dessert lane here.
There was a grasshopper pie with some chocolate
yes,
in it. And
okay,
then I had a parfait, like a peanut butter chocolate parfait with some crispy stuff. Whatever Mandy does is magic. So.
Yeah, I think that grasshopper pie is one that's really stands out because we went through testing of that with Mandy, and she's very, very particular, so she had to try five different things to make sure the grasshopper, I mean, everything Mandy does is made from scratch. And I'd say grasshopper pie. I have not been eating a lot of desserts. I've been trying all the other foods, so I have not had one thing I will say, her strawberry shortcake, also we do homemade biscuits. So
talk a little bit about some of the specialties at Luna. I wrote an article. I tried 16 Nefla soups locally here. That was a while ago, but Luna ranked number one. But there are a lot of other things at Luna other than Nefla soup and some very nice dishes, especially for dinner. And you have a cheese case too. So yeah, talk a little bit about what's offered at Luna.
I mean, I think some of our most popular things are cheese plates, obviously. We do a pretty mean cheese plate, and I sample a lot of them around town just to check. Our popovers, we're known for those. And then, yeah, I mean, our Nefla soup is always there. Our menu changes a lot more seasonally there. We really work with the farmers everywhere, but that one in particular, we changed the menu a little bit almost every day. So we actually just have paper menus because we have to change it so often.
Yeah. Now that breakfast is opened, what should we expect for breakfast?
We kind of did a combination. This one, I think, is a little more, it's not random, but there's just a little bit of everything on there. We did there's a couple dishes that sort of pay homage to burn bombs that just, you know, things that we wanted to kind of, we did our own spin on, but aren't anything they did. We have a smoked salmon plate. We, you know, have some muesli. But then we do fun things like beignets. And we use our prime rib in a different version for both a breakfast sandwich and a lunch. There's a French dip on there. What else? We just also have just like a regular, just old school bacon, eggs, toast, you know, potato breakfast. That was inspired by one of our friends, Richard Preston, who him and his wife Arlette have been huge supporters of us, and he just said, I just really want a great place I can go get a basic breakfast. I think we always have, you know, three, I think, kinds of toast, which are all home, like made in-house by Mandy. And then, you know, soups and salads for lunch, and then some of our we had a really casual old menu at our old Nova, and so some of those things made it onto that menu as well.
I think if I come over for lunch, I'm going to have a Nova Smashy. I'm looking at your
menu. Yeah.
My gosh, that looks good.
Our Nova Smash Burger was one of our most popular items on the old menu. Oh, and I can't forget to talk about the relish tray, which is something I just really wanted so bad on this menu. And Ryan, you know, at first he thought it would kind of be boring, and then he put his magic on it, and really, it's a pretty special relish tray. And we asked the community to support us or to supply us with relish trays. And so we have a lot of really cool old relish trays that everything comes on to. That's available day and night.
people should know it's a really neat location. It's unique. The decor is really unique. It's a supper club that's elevated. I love the pheasant wallpaper back in the bathrooms. My family's from southwestern North Dakota, so I like to go pheasant hunting, and I just like that little touch. And it's just a really neat place, unique, and I'm glad it's in downtown Fargo.
And it's about a block north from the Fargo Theater for those that are wanting to kind of pin it in their minds exactly where it is. Our guest has been Nikki Ness Berglund. She's the creative force behind Nova Eatery and Supper Club, which is now open on Broadway in Fargo, part of the Luna Network of restaurants. Rick, it's been a pleasure to have Nikki with us in the studio.
It really has, Nikki. We'll have you back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Rick, have a great week.
Thanks, buddy. Ka-dum, ka-dum,
ka-dum. Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck, dedicated to producing reliable electricity. Basin Electric operates generation stations in North Dakota, South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming, including wind projects in North and South Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Main Street continues today at the North Dakota Museum of Art, which is celebrating the opening of two new exhibitions, Guy Nelson and the exhibition Tales from the Understory, and From Paint to Print, Helen Frockenthaler's and the Art of Collaboration. Both exhibitions will be on display through July 20th at the North Dakota Museum of Art on the campus of the University of North Dakota. And we are pleased to be joined here on Main Street today with Guy Nelson. Guy, welcome to Main Street.
Welcome. Thank you.
What was the genesis of your relationship with the North Dakota Museum of Art?
Well, I'm from Fargo-Moorhead. Went to school a number of years ago at Minnesota State University Moorhead. And I first started going up there a number of years ago. And it was about 6-7 months ago, the museum contacted me to be part of their Art Maker series. So I'm the 10th in that series, and it's underwritten by Doctor of Fargo. And it gave me an opportunity to expand and really push myself, develop a new body of work or an extended body of work, and focusing on the upper Midwest, including North Dakota and Western Minnesota. So it's a lot of imagery of the outdoors, and so that's my relationship with them.
Tell us your history, Guy. When, I guess, did you decide, you know what, I'm going to be an artist?
Yeah, so I'm one of these artists that knew it early on. Like, I mean, I could go all the way back to kindergarten. You know, there's a drawing I actually have standing in front of an easel. So that's, it's just something I always knew I wanted to do.
If you were to explain to our listeners what kind of artist you are, what would you tell them?
I am a mixed media artist. However, most of what I'm making right now is painting. Painting, acrylic painting on linen and canvas. I have a history of making sculpture. The exhibition, Tales from the Understory at the museum, does include 23 paintings, 8 sculptures, and 2 videos. So I do tackle other projects, other medium when I feel necessary. And most of what I'm doing right now is painting after a shift in about 2016 when I decided to make that change.
You use the word understory of forests and prairies in this exhibition. What inspired you to focus on the understory?
So an understory is the forest floor. Growing up in and around forests in Western Minnesota, which really impacted my life, many, many years of just walking, looking down, focusing on the understory, really just kind of grew inside me. It is something, you know, my interest in that, I should say. So it's something that I can't shake. It's just like, I love being in a forest and like looking down. And actually a lot of the paintings you see is going to be from that perspective. It's that lower part of the tree. It's nothing in the canopy. So there's a lot of life in the understory. I'm fascinated by it. You know, how there's a synergy between plants and just really what it takes to survive as a plant organism.
I've been enthralled by the series that I believe is airing on NBC called The Americas, narrated by Tom Hanks. And as much as it is about wildlife, to me, it's about the beauty of plant life that we are surrounded by. And I'm curious, do you draw parallels between plant life and human experiences in your work?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. So I'm always thinking about that. And there's books I read about plant communities, and really what it comes down to is like how to plant. I'm thinking more like a garden, right? So like, what kind of plants do you have to have next to each other, things like that. But every time I read a book about plant diversity and community, I'm always thinking about the humans or human beings and how we are similar. And also a lot of my titles sometimes I'll actually pull from, you know, quotes directly from books dealing with plant community.
You talked about your transformation from sculpture and video to painting. How would you say that's worked for you? And do you miss focusing on those other mediums?
Yeah, so I still will make a sculpture or a video when I feel like it's needed. But no, I do not miss necessarily the waste of not only material waste, but also trying to take care of myself. I was doing a lot of mold making, dealing with polymers like resins, rubbers, things like that, lots of sanding, and all that stuff is really what was important for me to get away from, both from a waste point of view, thinking about the environment, but also a personal health. So I just I figured, you know what, the best thing for me to do is get back to the canvas where I could paint what I want to talk about.
Use acrylic mediums and spray paint to emulate the complexity of the outdoors. Why those tools? Because there are many other ways you can paint.
Yes. Well, when I went back to painting after many, many years off, I didn't know where to start. Like if I was going to go to acrylic or oil painting. And I learned really quick that the technology advancement with acrylic mediums and how I can extend an acrylic paint, make it fluid, things like that, I'm able to paint just like an oil painter can. So the other thing what I really liked is I wanted to, I don't have the patience to sit around for oil painting, so I like to work very, very quick. And they do make acrylic spray paint in a can, so that combination actually was kind of my perfect fit. So whenever I feel like I'm clamming up or like I'm getting too tight in my painting, I'll just attack it with the spray can and then just work it over again with the brush.
Growing up in Moorhead, how did that shape your artistic vision, do you think?
It was the time I got to spend with my dad. He did a lot of driving through the roads of Minnesota and also North Dakota. We would stop in fields, grain elevators. He had land in western Minnesota. It's now the land that I manage. That made a very big impact on me as far as being outdoors. And as far as directly Moorhead, that was just a very sweet community to grow up in, and I have just nothing but great memories of it.
You work in conservation and are a believer in land stewardship. It seems to me these themes really impact your artwork. Am I right about that?
Yes, and it's the land conservation stewardship is directly, it started about 4 years ago, actually, with the passing of my father. So when I had the opportunity to take care of the land and start cleaning up, what some of the debris, things like that was left behind, that has made I've enjoyed that and has actually become part of kind of my practice. So it's, if I'm not in the studio, if I could get a chance to go out to the land and plant a tree or walk the fields southeastern North Dakota, which is mostly grassland, that's where I'm at.
What do you hope people take away when they experience the exhibition?
Well, that there is still a wonder in the world, in the outdoors, and something it's right there. If we want it, we could go look for it. It's there's great things that could still be discovered, and if I could motivate another person to just slow down from their day to day and get outside, that would be great. Art is very important, and it should stay. And that is art. Yes, I'm a believer in art and its impact on all of us.
My guest has been Guy Nelson. His exhibition is Tales from the Understory. It's available to be seen at the North Dakota Museum of Art, which is on the campus of the University of North Dakota. Guy, it's been a pleasure and best wishes to you.
Thank you, Craig.
Still to come on Main Street, an interview with author Tamara Dean and her new book, Shelter and Storm. That's right after this. Welcome back to Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. As we continue today, we're visiting with author Tamara Dean. Her book, In Shelter and Storm, chronicles her deeply personal and richly observed journey of living intentionally and sustainably in Wisconsin's Driftless area. Tamara, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks for having me on, Craig.
In researching this article, I've been to Wisconsin several times. I have a son who lives there, but I didn't know where the driftless area was. Can we start there? Can you kind of explain to me what the driftless is in Wisconsin?
Yes, and no worries if you're not familiar with it. I lived in Madison for many years before I had even heard of it, and Madison is sort of right on the edge of the driftless area. It begins just a few miles west of Madison and continues to the Mississippi River. It's about 8,500 square miles in the southwest corner of Wisconsin mainly, although it does include a little bit of northwestern Illinois, and it's called the driftless area because it lacks glacial drift, which is the term geologists use for the sand and silt and pebbles and boulders that glaciers push ahead of them and then leave behind as they recede. And it's an area characterized by an entirely different topography than the rest of the Midwest. I mean, I grew up in mid-Michigan, which is completely flat, flattened by glaciers. But this area in southwestern Wisconsin has steep limestone bluffs and beautiful narrow river valleys and these clear spring-fed streams. It's really magically beautiful. Now, some recreationalists who are trout fishers or paddlers will also include the southeastern portion of Minnesota and the northeastern portion of Iowa in that driftless region because it's similar in topography and landmass. However, geologists have found some evidence of previous glaciers there. So technically, it's not the driftless area. But if you've never been there, I encourage people to visit, and I bet you'll fall in love with it just like we did.
Sure, enjoy the area that I now know I have driven through back and forth from our trips from here in North Dakota. The title of this book is interesting to me, Shelter and Storm. It evokes kind of refuge and disruption. How did you settle on the name, and what does it mean to you?
I think the name Shelter and Storm reflects the book both in its material and its themes. And in material, it's some of the essays in the book actually represent us building our house out of compressed earth blocks. It was a challenge we set ourselves to build an eco-friendly house that would be energy efficient and that hopefully long after we were gone, could compost back into the earth. So that's the shelter part. We imagined that also it would provide us with this refuge. And the driftless area has been a refuge for people since the previous glacier. The Ho-Chunk oral tradition tells of their ancestors being pushed southwest from what is currently Green Bay area to the driftless area because of the glaciers, the last glacier that went through. So it really is this area of refuge. A lot of people are drawn there to create new lives. And then the storm, obviously, the book contains tornado and floods. That area of Wisconsin is experiencing heavier and more frequent rain events as a result of climate change. And while we lived there, we experienced 7 record-breaking floods. The most recent one in August of 2018 was called a 1,000-year flood. And it was unlike anything anybody had seen. So the storms were both literal, but also figurative in, you know, the illnesses that we faced and the relationship challenges that my partner David and I had while we were living there.
What did it teach you about being resilient? I assume much.
Yes. You know, David and I tend to just keep plodding forward. Somebody asked me, you know, how do you think about this resilience? And I think, well, it wasn't that intentional. It was just we had to keep moving forward. And, you know, whether faced by a storm or the destruction of something we had built in an instant with this tornado, what can you do but carry on? And that was exemplified by our neighbors in so many ways, too. Another thing about living in rural Wisconsin is that the community, we learned, really sticks together. And partly it's a practical reason, you know, in those remote areas, emergency services aren't as quick to respond. They just can't be. So people come over if your prairie fire gets out of control, like ours did once, or in another instance, our cistern, which collected rainwater and was our only domestic water source, mysteriously drained and went empty while we were on vacation. And people we didn't even know offered their SAP truck to be taken to the fire station and filled with water. And nobody, well, everybody refused payment. They just said, no, it's on us and we're happy to do it. And no one ever asked about our politics or who we voted for. It just was never something that came up. So we learned a lot about community, and that contributes a lot to the resilience of that area.
Your background is in journalism. How did that influence your writing?
Yes, originally I was a systems engineer, and I worked with computers, computer networks. I wrote textbooks for college students on computer networking, and then I moved into fiction writing as well. But when I went to the country, I recognized, it seemed, every moment I stepped out the front door, something else astonishing would greet me, whether it was one of those storms or a rare animal or simply a turtle, you know, digging her nest right next to our front walkway. And I thought, you know, these occurrences in the country are so much more dramatic than any fictional plot lines. And that's when I really became an essayist, because I wanted to pick up on these mysteries. And I had so many questions, so much curiosity about what was confronting me. And I would just follow them and follow them. And then writing an essay was a way to synthesize my research and my experience and make meaning out of it. You know, we humans are storytellers. And for me, writing is a way to make sense of an experience.
When you were growing up, were you really an outdoorsy gal?
I was forced to be outdoorsy by my parents, a biologist and a chemist, who were never happier when they were outdoors. So I did enjoy the outdoors. I loved gardening and fishing and hiking. But oftentimes I was taken on hikes, you know, through the woods to forage. And my mom, being a biologist, would always be pointing out the plants and naming them for me. And even though sometimes I resisted those compulsory hikes, I certainly absorbed all that knowledge, and I'm grateful for that now.
Enjoying our conversation with Tamara Dean. She's a journalist and an essayist and an environmental thinker who's written the book Shelter and Storm. Tamara, you wrote candidly about the disillusionment with farming economics. And I want to know what advice you might have to give to people today who dream of small-scale farming.
My dream was to manage a diverse organic vegetable operation. And I had farming in my blood. My grandfather and all my grandfathers before him were farmers, according to municipal records and family stories. And I thought, well, I can do this, and I love gardening. But it turned out that growing acres of a crop for sale was so much more difficult than, of course, growing my own garden. And I couldn't get the economics to work out. I would keep making these back-of-the-envelope calculations about inputs and sales and markets. And without the USDA supports, the subsidies and grants and crop insurance that are offered to commodity crop growers, those people who grow corn and soy in the Midwest mainly, I didn't know how to make that work. So if you asked if I had any advice for people, I'd say start with modest aspirations. I mean, have a definite goal, but work on your economics before you enter this endeavor. Some places like Organic Valley, which was not too far from our place in the country, will also provide support not only in markets but in training. So go to those conferences of growers and pick either a specialty or a commodity crop where you know there's going to be a return for all your effort, because it is so much effort.
Your story of turning your fields into pollinator habitat is quite a triumph. It makes me feel guilty. I've been encouraged to turn my lawn into a pollinator habitat and haven't pulled that trigger yet. But you certainly have. And what role do you think these small acts, relatively speaking, of stewardship can then play in the climate crisis?
We know that pollinators like bees and butterflies are in trouble, and they're necessary for growing our crops. And in 2014, the Obama administration offered these grants for creating more pollinator habitat because they recognized the threat to our food system if pollinators are not supported. So yes, we did turn an old hay field into a restored prairie, but there are many other opportunities, as you noted, for smaller scale pollinator habitats, which really help even your yard or the area next to the railroad tracks or next to the road can help because those pollinators need a place to land. You know, they need a corridor for moving as they migrate, especially the monarchs, as we know. So even a patch of milkweed in your yard will be helpful.
Many of your essays really explore the tension of doing something, doing nothing in response to environmental disruption. It seems like it's easy for you to navigate that choice. It's hard for me.
I wouldn't say it's easy. I think I really got mired in indecision when we had a tornado destroy 40 acres of our forest. I was weighing all the factors. You know, if we logged it, we could get some income off of the downed timber. However, that timber had been shattered and split in a lot of cases, and it wouldn't earn as much at the mill as standing timber would. Also, the downed timber would create habitat for animals such as the ruffed grouse, which were finding it difficult to find habitat anymore. On the other hand, it's hard to do nothing. It's hard to look at a forest that you recognize as vertical, that you prefer as vertical, being horizontal. And it's such a mess. You know, you want to tidy things up. You want to create those alleys for the animals again. So there was a lot of indecision, and we came to a middle path on that. I decided to allow loggers in to take the easiest and most accessible logs. And then the places where the logs were down on this highly erodible land where logging would have harmed the environment more, we just said, we'll leave it there. And indeed, you know, within a few years, a new forest had grown up around it.
I want to talk about the emotional journey that you had really with living so closely with the land. And I'm going to preface it by telling you that for one summer, just after my wife and I were married, when our daughter was turning one, we were broke, college, just out of college students. And my high school science instructor and swim coach invited us to live in his earth home. It was a beautiful place right on top of the hill, built right into the side of the hill. Couldn't even see the house unless you knew where to look at it. But I often felt lonely because we were so ingrained into the land.
That's so interesting. It sounds like you might have been in a more remote location than we were. As I mentioned in the book, our house became an attraction for people passing by, and they would just stop and ask for a tour because they could see it was built a little differently than the houses around it. So we did give a lot of tours, and we were maybe half a mile from our closest neighbor, so it wasn't that remote and it wasn't hidden. But still, and even as we had this wonderful community around us, we missed some of the city amenities that we used to know. And so we would take some trips, as a lot of people did living out there, to cities such as Minneapolis, Madison, or Chicago to get an occasional fix of what we couldn't get out in the country.
I want to get back to the sense of community that you experienced when you had tough times. But I think that you also, in good times, loved your neighbors, loved your fellow farmers more than just a there they are human world. You had relationships.
Yes, I learned so much from my farmer neighbors. As I describe in one of the essay, actually called Good Neighbors, the farmer to the north of us had asked us to trap the beavers in the creek that bordered our properties. And, you know, because of the beavers damming that creek, his low-lying field had flooded. And we had trapped the beavers at his request once, but a new family had moved in, a new beaver family had moved into that creek right away. And so because it was perfect habitat, it didn't make sense to keep trapping in our eyes. We came up with another solution based on commercial solutions called the beaver deceiver or the caster master, which essentially mask the sound of water flowing by plunging a tube underneath the creek, and that drains the flood or that drains the pond that the beavers have made because of their dam. So it's continually draining, but they can't hear it. So they're not prompted to keep building. And this worked well for us. And after the neighbor had come to our doorstep, you know, so angry about his low-lying field flooding again, we went to him and said, okay, we fixed the problem. And he didn't even seem to care. And we thought something is not right. And we learned later from another neighbor that he was facing a terminal illness. And, you know, he was mourning the loss of a way of life, certainly, but also of his own life.
You've also authored a book called The Human Powered Home. And I know we're not talking about that today, but the title is just intriguing to me. I see you on your bicycle. Of course, it's not that. Pedaling away, generating power. Tell me about a little bit about that book.
I was also fascinated by human-powered devices. You know, a lot of people imagine what would it save me in electricity, for instance, if I could pedal power my TV, and how fit would I get if I did that? That was one of my questions too. And I began searching for uses of pedal powered and treadled and hand crank devices around the world.
Oh my gosh, I was kind of on the right track.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh.
Absolutely. Yeah. I had a pedal powered electrical generator, and in our house, we had a pedal powered grain mill, hand crank coffee grinder, of course, but we also made a pedal powered concrete mixer, cement mixer, sorry. And we used that sometimes to mix the plaster for the straw bale outbuilding that we made. We tried straw bale before we tried compressed earth blocks, but our valley was just too humid for that to be practical. So we made all kinds of pedal powered, treadled, and hand crank devices. But really, what intrigued me about that book was getting to know people from around the world who were designing and implementing and offering these devices. It's an example of appropriate technology in a place where they don't have money to purchase or operate certain machines. This pedal-powered technology can really take the place of, you know, something more expensive, more complex. And these people are not doing it to get rich. They're doing it because they have a passion and they see a need and they want to offer something. So they were very enthusiastic and committed. And I love talking with those people and featuring their stories in the book.
Were there any essays that didn't make it into your current book, In Shelter and Storm?
There were some essays that didn't make it into Shelter and Storm, primarily because they didn't embody that tension that's suggested in the title, Shelter and Storm, meaning, you know, refuge and threat. Other tensions in the book have to do with isolation and community, or, you know, health and illness. But some essays that I wrote didn't feel as if they embodied that strong tension, which I wanted for Shelter and Storm. And then in other cases, I have to say that some of the essays that did end up in the book were not ever meant for publication. Initially, for instance, I began the essay, which is called An Ordinary Woman, and was published as Safer Than Childbirth, simply as an exercise for myself. Neighbors had told us for many years that Civil War soldiers were buried in the cemetery on our property, but their tombstones had been washed downstream by the epic flood of 1978. So I had lived on our property for over 10 years before I finally went to the County Historical Society and said, hey, is it true that we have Civil War soldiers buried in our cemetery? And the list I got back contained no men. They did contain the the list did show the three little children whose tombstones were still in the cemetery, but it also listed two women, and both women had died of puerperal peritonitis, which is a complication of pregnancy, whether miscarriage, abortion, or birth. And I just went off on the story of one of those women, and really it was an essay to answer these neighbors who had given all of the valor and value to the lives of fictitious Civil War soldiers in the place of these two young women who had died because they were pregnant.
When someone reads the book, what do you hope they carry with them?
I hope readers recognize the importance of maintaining an open mind and an open heart when they go out into nature and interact with community too.
Our guest has been author Tamara Dean. The book, Shelter and Storm, where she chronicles her deeply personal and richly observed journey of living intentionally and sustainably in Wisconsin's driftless area. Tamara, it's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me on, Craig. It's been nice talking with you.
Programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 16th. In 1872, European Americans founded a modest settlement at what was called Missouri Crossing. It got its name because the Lewis and Clark expedition crossed the river there on their journey to explore the Louisiana Purchase. The settlers named their new community Edwinton, after Edwin Ferry Johnson, an engineer with the Northern Pacific Railroad. Less than a year later, the name was changed to Bismarck, in honor of German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck, aiming to attract German immigrants. In its early days, Bismarck was a rough-and-tumble place. Camp Greeley was established by the U.S. Army to protect settlers and railroad workers. It was named after the famous newspaper editor and 1872 Republican presidential candidate Horace Greeley. A year later, it was renamed Camp Hancock in honor of General Winfield Scott Hancock, the commander of the Department of Dakota. The post served as a staging ground for Army supplies that could be shipped by rail, wagon, or steamboat to posts further west. In 1874, the Signal Corps set up operations at Camp Hancock. Their primary mission was to transmit and receive military messages. As hostilities across the west began to subside, the Signal Corps also served as an early weather station, recording and maintaining weather records. The last troops left Camp Hancock in 1877, though a small staff remained to manage the weather station and a quartermaster's depot. The camp was finally closed for good on this date in 1894. Reminders of the past still echo in Bismarck. The Camp Hancock Historic Site, located at 101 East Main Avenue, preserves North Dakota history dating back to 1872. The Interpretive Center is housed in a log headquarters building, remodeled over the years, with clapboard siding concealing the logs. It is the oldest building in Bismarck and contains artifacts from the days before North Dakota was a state. The Bread of Life Church, built in 1880, was relocated to the site in 1965. Also at the site is a 1909 Northern Pacific Railroad locomotive. This hidden gem is the perfect place to explore the history of North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
President Trump doesn't want to stop at sending migrants to prison in El Salvador. He says he wants to send U.S. citizens too. Critics say that's wrong.
There are profound ethical questions that this would signal about how we treat human beings who are U.S. citizens.
That story on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for Prairie Public's Main Street on this Wednesday. We are deeply grateful that you spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, our great friend and extraordinarily capable movie reviewer Matt Olean stops by. We'll talk about the indie movie, Bob Trevino Likes It, and Dave Thompson and I will review this week's news here in North Dakota, and there'll be more. And we hope you can join us again tomorrow, right here on Main Street.